laughed. How old are you, dude? You just put your freaking thumb on the freaking pad. It's not rocket science. I don't like gadgets, complained Top. The guard overseeing the scan looked amused and gave Bunny a knowing wink, more or less saying, old guys. Once the scan was complete, Top and Bunny were told to wait near the guard shack. No one bothered to check the scanner housing, and even if they had, they might not have noticed anything odd. Only a very close examination would reveal a very small dot of plastic stuck to the underside of the machine. The dot had been on the pad of Top's left forefinger, and when he touched it to the device while bending over to frown and cuss at the machine, the reactive chemical scanned and mimicked the exact color of the housing. When he held on to the scanner while finally placing his thumb in the right place, Top transferred the chameleon scanner to the housing. It was a bit of sleight of hand he'd done many times before. The scanner was a marvel of design developed years ago by Doctor Who and updated by Tex working for Doc Holliday and Bug. Within 6 seconds, the microcircuitry in the wafer-thin dot was opening a door to allow Mind Reader to waltz in. The super intrusion software around which Mind Reader was built instantly picked all the encryption locks built into the Blue Diamond security system. At the same time, it rewrote the target software to erase all traces of the intrusion and its lingering presence. No one at the camp would raise an alarm because nothing within the security system recognized the intrusion. While they waited, Top and Bunny glanced briefly around. The camp looked rustic, but their security was not. The guards wore a slightly different uniform from the ones they'd seen in Texas, camo with a slightly darker color scheme, appropriate for the denser woodlands here in Washington State. No insignias except for small blue diamond-shaped patches on the shoulders. The cut was better, suggesting individual tailoring rather than off the rack, and these men had sharper eyes and unsmiling mouths. Observant professionals. And yet, Top's tomfoolery with the scanner had tricked them. That suggested a bit of arrogance over the professionalism. Top and Bunny both thought it was useful to know. Colonel Ledger had a theory about that, or perhaps an observation. He called it the arrogance of power. When the strong and abusive assume the weaker potential prey were inarguably easy targets because they were weaker. It was the assumption used by so many rapists, child abusers, muggers, and similar predatory monsters. Gangs often made the same assumptions, and in the absence of training, natural or acquired confidence or preparedness, they were often right. But just as the larger male lions learn to their peril when trying to bully the lionesses with cubs, underestimation can backfire quickly. It also led to habits of inattention. And that's what Top and Bunny both hoped would be at work here. This was, after all, an elite camp. Lots of testosterone, lots of predators thinking with their biceps, sidearms, and contempt. Bunny caught Top's eye, and they shared a tiny, knowing smile. A golf cart came whisking silently up, and they climbed into the back. The driver was every bit as chatty as a potted plant. As soon as they were seated, he set off along the road. They made sure to look around at everything, partly to collect intel for themselves, and partly to make sure the tiny body cams they wore picked up useful data for Bug. As they drove, Scott Wilson began speaking quietly in their ears, his voice as clear as if he were in the cart with them rather than on an island 6,000 miles away.
"This is rather exciting," said Wilson. "We had no idea this camp even existed. None of the fixers we are... interviewed, ever mentioned, or even hinted about it. Be aware, lads, that it will take a bit of time to arrange for drone flyovers, so try not to get into trouble."
Top casually tapped the lowest button on his shirt, signaling the affirmative.
"Jackpot and Mother Mercy are inbound and will be on station within 3 hours. Jackpot has his whole bag of tricks with him, including bird drones appropriate to that region."
Another tap.
"And if you're asked to change clothes," continued Wilson, "we can attune the drones to your RFID chips. We won't lose you, chaps."
Leaning a little on that, another of the thousand subtle ways each of them was reminded of Joe Ledger. Top gave another tap.
The path through the woods was not long, but was made up of deliberate switchbacks so that screens of old-growth trees foiled any chance of visual surveillance from the ground. The dense canopy of pine needles hid the road from the air. Smart and effective. A camp like this couldn't be found by accident or even through normal flyover surveillance. You had to know it was there. Their silent driver passed through another checkpoint with an even sturdier gate and then entered a compound made up of many small one-story buildings draped with camouflage netting. Even the outside areas used for drills were under a canopy. No smoke from cooking fires or heaters, which meant they probably used electric or propane. And as they got out of the cart, they saw a row of industrial generators chugging away. "Nice place," Bunny said to the driver, but got no response. "You're a regular chatty Cathy." The man stared into the middle distance, still behind the wheel. When they stepped away from the cart, he drove off. That left the two of them standing a dozen yards inside the gate. They dropped their bags and waited for the next play. Chapter 57. Hamlet of Arbatax Tortoli, Province of Nuoro, Sardinia, Italy. Bruno Melis was 103 years old and still had most of his teeth, his eyesight, and a memory that stretched back to before his days as a pilot in World War II. His wife, of 80 years, Maria, was 14 months in her grave, bless the Virgin Mary. Angelo, Bruno's youngest son, was 77 and still walked with his father 2 miles every afternoon to split their daily bottle of wine in Enoteca Mirai, which had been in his wife's family since the days when Catalan conquerors ruled the entire island of Sardinia. Bruno had seen a century's worth of history. But he had never seen anything like what happened at the house of the banker who lived on the hill overlooking the Tyrrhenian Sea. Bruno's own house, much more modest than the banker's, though large by the standards of Arbatax, was on a promontory and offered a view over a part of the southern wall into the banker's rear garden. On many an evening, Bruno had seen the banker, a man known only by the surname of Otranto, receive guests after banking hours. He knew they were guests and not friends, because there were handshakes, but no embraces, no laughter. No bottles of wine drunk as the sun set and the stars above ignited like God's party lights. People spoke in whispers about those guests because they nearly always arrived by boat around twilight and left in the dead of night. Few ever stayed the night at Otranto's house, and none ever stayed in the town. They came quietly and left quietly, and no one ever knew their names. They were unusual visitors. Most were clearly not Sardinian or even Italian. There were Asian and African visitors and others dressed in clothes more like what people wore on TV shows from England or America or Russia. To Bruno and his small circle of friends, it was clear these visitors were there to do business, and business of a kind not conducted at the bank offices or in bistros or enoteche like normal and respectable people did. But Otranto never caused a problem, nor did his guests. They came, they did whatever business they did, and they left. Always quiet, always discreet, and life went on. Then the man arrived on a small boat. A man dressed all in black and accompanied by a very large white dog. Bruno saw the boat come motoring to a deserted section of beach just as the last of the day's light was dying like embers on the wave tops. Despite his age, Bruno saw very well, and besides, his great-great-grandson had sent him a very fine telescope 4 Christmases ago. For bird-watching and stargazing, the boy had said, though everyone in the family knew that Bruno was a little bit of a snoop. That was not how he saw himself, of course. He considered himself a people-watcher, a perpetual student of human activity. Otranto was merely one of the people he watched, because Bruno was intrigued by the clandestine nature of those secret backyard meetings. He spotted the man nearly by accident, and had he gone inside a few minutes sooner to use the bathroom, he would not have seen him at all. However, one of the benefits of being very old was that he didn't need to use the bathroom with any real urgency anymore. When he got there, it would be time enough. So he saw the big man and the big dog get out of the black boat. Bruno watched him through his Kawa spotting scope as the man unzipped a duffel bag and removed a kind of suit of armor that looked like what the Nucleo Operativo Centrale di Sicurezza wore on news stories about dangerous police raids. Body armor. The man also put on a helmet and a strange pair of oversized goggles. Then he removed weapons from the bag. Handguns and a rifle, but Bruno did not know modern makes and models. After the war, his war of more than 75 years ago, Bruno had only ever used a shotgun, and that was for rabbits. He could not remember the last time he'd even held a firearm. 1970, perhaps, or a few years later. The guns he saw through his telescope looked like something from TV, or one of those movies about special forces. Ugly things, lacking any aesthetics. Bruno watched him attach some of the armor around the dog's body and even a kind of skull cap over the dog's head, but which left the animal's eyes, ears, and snout free. It was a strange thing to watch, very much like television, and nearly as entertaining, though it also filled him with a growing sense of unease. There were no movie cameras down there on the beach. His unease grew as the man left the beach and hiked, with his dog, up a sheep path into the hills toward Otranto's compound. For nearly 5 full minutes, Bruno argued with himself about whether to call the police, but a voice, very much that of his late wife, spoke in his head and told him not to get involved.
Ad arbatax è arrivata l'oscurità,
the ghost of his wife seemed to whisper. A darkness has come to Arbatax. He thought about that for a long time as the man and dog climbed the steep hill. A darkness. The echo of those words through his mind seemed to pull the lingering heat of the day out of his world, leaving Bruno Melis cold and frightened. So he watched and made no call, not even to his son, who lived not half a kilometer from where he sat. The shadows of night swallowed the man entirely, and for nearly 20 minutes there was nothing to see. Bruno even began wondering if senility was finally, after all these years, catching up with him. He was the 5th oldest person currently living in Arbatax, a town known for centenarians, and there were 17 people over 100 who were younger than he was. Some had lost their faculties, but he had not, a fact he ascribed to his daily walks, his daily crossword puzzles, and the wine he shared with his son. He sat on his little stool and peered into the scope and tried to calculate the rate of climb for the man and where he might reappear among the rocks and shrubs. Bruno's estimate was correct nearly to the minute. The dog emerged from the broom shrubs 40 meters from Otranto's garden wall. By now it was full dark, and the patio lights were burning behind the big house. Otranto himself was smoking a cigar as he strolled along the flagstones in his yard, speaking on a cell phone while two of his men, Bruno assumed they were bodyguards of some kind, stood watching, silent as statues. A flash of gunfire sparked through the night, but Bruno did not hear the echo of shots. Through the excellent lens of his scope, he saw that the pistol the big man held had some kind of silencer on it. Fire spat from the barrel, but even as the two bodyguards fell, Otranto, looking the other way as he talked on his phone, did not appear to hear. Then the dog rushed past the man and dragged Otranto down, savaging his arm. Not trying to kill him, though, that much was clear. The big man went into the house while the dog stood guard like Cerberus over the bleeding Otranto. There were many flashes inside the house, and the reports of guns, not silenced ones, bounced up the hills toward Bruno. Then a window exploded outward, and another burly man went flying out and landed, badly, on the flagstones. After a while, was it 30 seconds or a full minute, silence and stillness fell over the house of Otranto. Soon the big man came back out of the house carrying an armful of computer laptops, which he placed on the patio. He waved his dog away and knelt by the banker.
Bruno was not sure whether he wished he could have heard the conversation that followed or not. Maybe not. He watched, though, riveted to his seat, unable to look away, until the knife came out. After that, Bruno turned away, appalled, sickened. He pressed one hand to his chest, sure that his old heart was going to burst. With the other, he crossed himself and said a prayer to the Madonna. Over and over again, as sweat beaded his face and the world seemed to swim around him. Then, finally, he summoned the courage to turn back to his telescope and look down at the patio. And this time his heart nearly did freeze. The big man stood above a red ruin of a thing that had once been Otranto. The man was not looking at the dead banker, nor at the fallen guards or even the house, no. The big man was looking up the hill toward the promontory on which Bruno Melis sat. The goggles were off, and the balaclava too. The big man had blonde hair that was soaked with sweat and plastered to his scalp. He was unshaven and hollow-eyed. But he was looking directly at Bruno. There was no way he could see that far without at least binoculars, and Bruno sat in the utter blackness of his unlighted backyard. He had not even gone inside to turn on the kitchen light. The man, though, seemed to see him anyway. There was something wrong about the way he stood, about the way he looked. It was as if Bruno was seeing a cutout of a man pasted badly onto the moment. Shadows seemed to cling to the man, though he was not near enough to the house or the garden wall for any shadow to fall across him. The man looked at Bruno and gave a single, slow nod. And then he turned, picked up the stack of laptops, stuffed them into an empty backpack, slung the pack, gestured to his dog, and left. Bruno did not watch them go back down the hill. No, by then he was in his house, the doors locked and windows closed. Bruno sat by the cold hearth, clutching his wife's crucifix to his chest, praying. What surprised him, though, was that he was not praying for his own immortal soul, nor the souls of the people he had just watched die. For some reason he could never thereafter explain to himself, his son, his friends, or the police. He prayed for the soul of that stranger. He prayed far into that night. Interlude 12. The Pavilion, Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington, 4 months ago.
"This is the target," said Eve.
The 12 fixers, known around the pavilion as the Righteous, stood in a loose half-circle around Eve. Behind where she stood was a trifold set of portable monitors, each 7 feet high, and capable of 4,096 by 2,160 pixel density, giving the images incredible clarity. The images being shown were also manipulated by a program that made sure that the central figure on each screen remained exactly the same height, actual height for the star of those video files. At first, watching that was a bit jarring, but the eye and the mind adjusted quickly. All three monitors featured the same person, a bit over 6 feet tall, blonde-haired, and blue-eyed, very fit, and as the file display speed was not in any way adjusted, clearly very fast. Whether fighting with a blade, a gun, or his hands, he seemed to blur at times. One of the fixers raised a hand.
"Miss Eve," he said. "Is that Mr. Stafford?"
Michael Augustus Stafford had been a lecturer briefly there at the pavilion a few months back. Eve blinked in surprise and turned to look at the image.
"Huh," she said. "You know, I never noticed the similarities before, but damn, you're right. They could almost be brothers. But Stafford's better looking."
A few of the men chuckled. The rest did not.
"No, campers," she continued, stabbing a finger toward the center screen. "This is Colonel Joe Ledger. Some of you know him, but mostly by reputation. Or going to funerals of friends of yours he killed."
That got a few nods and some glares.
"He is the number one pain in the ass of Kuga and Daddy, Rafael Santoro. He and his team have been fucking with them since long before they put this new organization together.
She rattled off what amounted to Joe Ledger's greatest hits, giving them the official case code names lifted a couple of years ago during a hack of the DMS records. Patient Zero and the Saif al-Din pathogen, the Jacobis and the Dragon Factory, the Seven Kings and the Sea of Hope, the Assassin's Code and the Red Knights, on and on.
And then last year they barged into our Rage operation and nearly spoiled everything.
One of the fixers said,
I heard that he messed up Mr. Santoro pretty bad.
Eve turned toward him very slowly, and the look in her eyes was so venomous that he actually recoiled a step.
Daddy won that fight, she snarled.
Hey, I didn't mean nothing. I was just...
You were just sticking your dick in your own mouth, is what you were doing.
But then Eve caught sight of HK across the room watching the session. It was like a cup of cold water on a burn. Eve took a breath and made herself focus. As Daddy so often said,
when emotions rule your thoughts and words and actions, then you are their slave.
She forced a smile onto her face, cold and fragile, but it held.
Do you want to know what else Ledger did?
She asked, impressed at how reasonable her voice now sounded. She reached down and tapped the knee brace she wore.
He put his gun to my knee while I was helpless and shot me. I'm going to have the entire knee replaced, and at my age that means it'll wear out in maybe 10 years and I'll have to get another, and another, another. So it'll be like him shooting me over and over again.
One of the men, Spiro, breathed.
Damn.
The fixer who'd made the comment about Santoro straightened.
Tell you what, Miss Eve, you point me in his direction and I'll cut his balls off and have them put in one of those acrylic paperweights and give that to you gift-wrapped. How's that?
She walked over to him. The man was easily 11 inches taller than she was, so she had to reach up to pat his cheek. One pat, another, and then a sharp crack of a slap. But she smiled as she slapped him, and he understood. He grinned down at her. Eve turned to look at them all.
We have a lot of footage of Joe Ledger in combat. We know what kinds of martial arts he's studied. We know he prefers a Wilson rapid-release folding knife. And we know he's a much better shot with a handgun than a long gun. We know that one of his most dangerous skills is a rare and complete lack of hesitation. We know he isn't fancy. No moves that are there for style rather than effect. That makes him an apex predator in our line of work.
She paused.
You 12 were picked because you have similar backgrounds and skill sets. However, you need to up the game and tilt the odds in your favor by becoming completely familiar with him, his body, his movements, his speed and power. Know him. Become him. So that if you ever meet him, he'll be facing his own skill set and yours. That, boys, is the edge.
They nodded. One or two looked mildly apprehensive or skeptical, and Eve took note of that. The rest looked merely ready to learn.
One last thing, she said. From this moment on, you're going to stop being who you were, and you'll become my team. I'll give you new combat call signs, and you'll use them 24/7 from now on. Spiro, you're Cain. Bobby, you're Abel.
She gave them each a biblical first name.
You answer to me and only me, is that understood?
Yes, ma'am, they shouted.
That means you'll do whatever I say, whenever I say it. No arguments, no complaints, no questions. Is that understood?
Yes, ma'am.
You'll still be fixers, but you are my fixers. You're the righteous. Let me hear you say that and mean it.
We are the righteous, they said,
tripping only slightly on that.
No, boys, say it like you mean it,
said Eve, giving them a dazzling smile.
Say it like you love me.
We are the righteous, they roared,
and each and every one of them said it like they loved her. Chapter 58. Van Dijk, Biomechanica, Rotterdam, the Netherlands. The barking dog woke him and nearly killed him.
The man saw the headlights coming toward him without any understanding of where he was or why he was driving. Reflexes took over. No hesitation, no panic. His hands moved on the wheel, one foot on the brake, the other on the gas, adjusting, compensating, avoiding by inches. The Doppler wail of the truck horn scolding him as the semi blew past, rocking the car. Then, the road ahead was clear. No oncoming lights. Nothing at all, except a wash of pale moonlight over the asphalt and headlights on road signs. They were all in Dutch. Well, Dutch and English. That made no sense. Why were Italian road signs in Dutch? He slowed to a stop and looked around. He was on a country road, two lanes. The billboard beside advertised a Burger King 4 kilometers away, but the street address was in Rotterdam. "What the fuck?" he whispered. In the back seat, the dog barked again. Just once. A hungry bark. The man realized that he was hungry, too. Starving, actually. With only that as a destination, he stepped on the gas and drove. He remembered ordering food, remembered opening 3 burgers for Ghost, remembered eating while sitting in a darkened parking lot of a closed factory. Thoughts drifted out of the shadows and he grabbed at them, hoping to puzzle them together, to form some kind of picture, hoping for coherence and cohesion, for insight. He remembered faces and names, some of them. Engelbrecht, Bischlow, Fong, Orlando, Barbagnagra, Kashak, Jones, others. Names belonging to dead faces. No, not all. Some he was certain were still alive. Had that been circumstance or mercy? He couldn't be sure. Not on any level of his awareness. And information, so much of it. Cybernetics, chemical therapies, something called a K-110, militia groups, explosives, implants, chips. Something else, too. He spoke that last thing aloud. The American operation. Hearing it aloud triggered something, but not the right thing. No details, merely dread. The American operation. He said again and looked at Ghost as if the dog were able to fill in the details. Ghost looked up from a burger that he was eating with great delicacy, and for a moment those dark brown eyes softened, became wet, which made his own eyes burn with unshed tears. "What's happening to me?" asked the man. "What's happening to us?" Suddenly there was nothing else in the conscious part of his mind as the darkness inside that overwhelmed the darkness outside the car. He did not notice the hundreds of nightbirds lined up along the edges of the building's roof or strung out along the telephone lines. Chapter 59. Hamlet of Arbatax, Tortoli, Province of Nuoro. Michael Augustus Stafford walked slowly through the ruins of the mansion on the cliff. Everything that could break appeared to have been deliberately and viciously smashed. The furniture was slashed, as were the expensive paintings on the wall. He paused in front of a rather nice modernist painting by Dino Basaldella that had to have sold for north of 50,000. Now it was tatters, worthless to anyone. And a number of Auguste Moreau bronzes, each of them signed, were broken or bent out of shape. Clearly they had been used to do some of the damage in the room, and some of the damage to the staff. The bodies of the victims were all gone now, but Stafford had photos on his cell phone to match against the dried bloodstains on the carpet, tiles, and walls. Hundreds of shell casings still littered the floor, and bullet holes pocked every possible surface. One round had punched a neat hole through a blue-and-white Yuan Dynasty vase without shattering the whole thing. A low-caliber, high-powered round, he judged. He had a couple of boxes of Stinger 22LR rounds at home that could have done that. It was interesting, though. He was a collector of art and felt a twinge for the lost treasures, but he was more impressed with the amount of damage and the skill insinuated by it. According to the police report, there had been one intruder and a dog.
"You're a madman, Ledger," he said aloud. "Can't wait to meet you."
He walked through the place, following the logical path of destruction. Even with sound suppressors and the element of surprise, Ledger must have been moving at incredible speed. Sure, the guards probably thought this place too inaccessible and too tough a nut to crack, and maybe that made them a little lazy, but once the shooting started, they'd have gotten up to speed quickly enough. They were pros. And Ledger had killed them all. In the military, that's called having a John Wayne day. But even so, even with the breaks going his way, the sheer enormity of all this was incredible. He wondered if he could have done it. This would be at the upper range of anyone's skill set. When he reached the master suite at the top of the house, he stopped in the doorway and stared. It looked as if someone had attached a fire hose to a tank full of dark red paint and then cut loose. Stafford tried to do the math on the blood spatter and still came up short. What had happened here? Stafford knew that Ledger had been pushed all the way to the edge by what Santoro had done to his family. Okay, there was the edge, but this was past that. And that called to mind a whole raft of Nietzsche quotes, and as he walked into the room, he spoke them aloud, fitting each like puzzle pieces to Ledger's fractured psyche.
"That which does not kill us makes us stronger."
That was often not true, as Stafford knew. Santoro proved that with virtually everyone he went to work on. Most people crumble under a certain level of pressure, and even if they survive, they're crippled by their own immutable awareness of how fragile and powerless they truly are. But when that statement was true in those rare cases, then it was a cosmic verity. Santoro had tried to break Ledger's heart and mind and will, but instead he'd made him into this. Into a monster. Maybe Santoro didn't understand that. He'd won so often with people, broken the unbreakable, that he lost perspective.
"And those who were seen dancing were thought to be insane by those who could not hear the music."
Santoro, and possibly Kuga, were drinking their own Kool-Aid, believing the hype that was scaring the piss out of the tourists in the business. He walked through the room, seeing the blood, matching it to the bodies in his photos. This is where the last stand had been.
"Whoever fights monsters should see to it that in the process he does not become a monster. And if you gaze long enough into an abyss, the abyss will gaze back into you."
The Christmas Eve slaughter had been Ledger's abyss, and he'd looked way too close. He'd become a monster, an actual monster. Stafford stopped by the wall over the bed. It was smeared with thick blood that had now dried to the color of bricks. He studied it in exactly the same way he studied the brush strokes of Van Gogh, Paul Wright, and Philippe Pasqua. There was so much to learn from the way an artist applied his brush, or knife, or fingers. This was artwork, of a kind. There were strokes within it. Fingers had played on this wall, moving through the red, running blood, even as the corpses lay cooling around the room, even as the smell of death permeated the air.
"There is always some madness in love," he said, one of Nietzsche's less frequently quoted insights. "But there's also always some reason in madness."
So, what then was the reason in this madness? What was Ledger saying to himself, or about himself? He did not believe that it was a cry for help, nothing as weak as that, or as pedestrian. And yet there was a message here. He could feel it. Stafford walked around the room, looking at the big smear from a dozen angles. Finally, he turned out the lights and used his cell to shine a bright blue-white beam at the swirls from several different angles, and that's when he saw them. Two words were smashed together, written in a fit of rage, the letters colliding, violating one another, bursting through each other.
Umbra, tenebris. Two Latin words, each casting a different meaning but inextricably linked, bound together by the intended meaning here. He spoke the translated word aloud. Darkness. It made him shiver. It made him smile.
Chapter 60. Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Church tapped on the open door of Bug's office.
Word is that you have something for me? He said.
Maybe I do.
Church closed the door and Bug activated the lockout system.
Still no actual sightings of Joe, said Bug, but what I'm calling discovery via circumstantial evidence.
Church sat. Bug opened a drawer and removed a package of vanilla wafers and handed it to him. Church smiled and opened it, selected one, and bit off a piece. He brushed crumbs from his tie.
Enlighten me, he said.
Last night someone broke into a sport boat rental company in Singita Miracle Beach in Malta and stole something called a gomoni.
Church nodded.
That's a commercial version of the rib.
The rigid hull inflatable boats were used by both military and private sportsmen because they were fast, light, and extremely durable.
And you think this was our missing friend?
Yep. All their security cameras seemed to malfunction at the same time.
Funny how that keeps happening. Church took another bite, chewed, then asked, Where is Mrs. Gondek?
Peggy Ann Gondek was a semi-retired field agent who had worked with Church and Aunt Sally in the days before the DMS. She was part of a network of associates whom Church trusted and occasionally employed.
Her flight touched down in Rome 3 hours ago. I've sent her the relevant information. She said she'll try to work up a list of possible targets. Her horseback guess is that Joe got a lead on some black market stuff right there in Rome and may have swiped the boat to go out to someone's yacht or maybe a freighter taking whatever Kuga's selling. Second guess would be one of the biotech labs in either Rome or Naples. There are 5 on our watch list. And then there's the bioweapons broker in Sardinia, but his place is a fortress, so Joe might leave that to us or the Crociati. It would take a small army for that gig.
The Crociati, Crusaders, were an Italian rapid response team modeled after the UK's Barrier and Church's former group, the DMS.
So my money's on one of the targets right there in Rome.
One more thing, said Church. Have you made any progress on whatever Kuga might be planning in America?
Progress is an ugly word, said Bug. I've been noodling around on some dark websites, and all I can find so far is that one of Kuga's black market crews moved some weapons into the U.S. via trucking routes from Canada. Don't have manifests, but it's a fair amount. And before you ask, I had Mind Reader poke around in surveillance logs from the CIA, DOD, and Homeland, but there's no indication of any nuclear materials. My guess is it's guns and ammo.
Being sold to whom?
Bug fished around in the mess of papers on his desk, found a pair of stapled pages, and handed them to Church. The big man scanned the lists.
These are mostly militia groups, some very far out on the political fringe.
All with avowed nationalistic politics. Bunch of them are white supremacists, too.
But not all, mused Church.
No. Doesn't mean much, except they're buying from the same vendor. Kuga's undercutting everyone else's prices.
Put Nikki Bloom on this, said Church. Her whole team. There's a pattern in here, and we're not yet seeing it.
Bug glanced up at him.
You think there really is something big brewing?
I do.
Any idea what?
No. That's why I want Nikki on it. Nobody finds a pattern better than she does.
Agreed. I'll go over this with her right away.
He paused.
Is this on the same level of hush-hush as tracking Joe?
No. Brief Scott on it as well.
Okie dokie.
This is all very good work, Bug.
Church stood up.
You know that I appreciate all that you do.
Bug smiled faintly.
You don't need to say it.
I do, said Church, and should probably say it more often.
With that, he left the office. Chapter 61. Van Dyke Biomechanica, Rotterdam, the Netherlands.
Tell me about the American operation,
said the man. I won't ask again. The scientist backed away, his feet slipping in the blood. He wanted to turn, to run, but the dog stood there by the exit to the stairs, and the big man with the knife was between him and the main door. The scientist's name was DeVries. He was corrupt, and willingly so. He was bought and owned, and content with that. He was also trapped.
"Please,"
he mewled. "I can make you tell me," warned the big man. "You know I can." The knife was red, and the hand holding it was scarlet to the wrist. All around the room was evidence of what the knife could do, and what the man was willing to do, if this man was really a man at all. There was something wrong about him. He seemed to be darker than anyone should be, given the bright fluorescent lights, and there was something in his face, in his eyes. They seemed to burn, to give off real heat.
"I'm going mad," thought DeVries.
"If you tell me," said the man, "I may let you live." The scientist's back thumped against the wall.
What?
"You heard me. It's the one chance you have. The only chance." The man was so close now. DeVries held his hands up in a gesture of surrender, a plea for mercy. He knew who this man was. Everybody in the network was talking about him, yelling about him, screaming about him. The insane American and his dog, Colonel Joe Ledger and Ghost. Monsters, both of them. Ledger stepped very close now and placed the blade of the knife against DeVries's cheek. The flat, not the edge. It was almost a caress, almost tender, but in the worst possible way.
"You're him,"
gasped DeVries.
"You're Ledger."
That made the American smile, but it was not a good smile. No, not at all. There was death in that smile. There was hell in it. "Joe Ledger isn't here right now," said the man. "I am."
I don't understand."
"Tell me while you still have a tongue." DeVries felt his bladder go. A moment later, his sphincter failed as well. Then his knees. He thumped down to the floor, his trousers filled with piss and shit. He could not look at Ledger. He dared not look away. So DeVries closed his eyes, squeezing them shut. He jammed his bald fists against his head, and he told the monster everything he knew. He talked for a long, long time. When he was finished, when there were no more follow-up questions, DeVries toppled over and curled into a ball on the floor, waiting for the knife, waiting for the pain. He lay there for a very long time. So long. He felt as if his mind and body, perhaps even his soul, were shutting down, preparing to be ended, preparing to meet God or the devil. He prayed to saints whose names he had thought he'd forgotten, to a God he had abandoned before he'd entered university. He wept and he prayed. Perhaps he even slept. When he finally summoned the courage to open his eyes, he was alone. Completely alone. With the awareness of having soiled himself. With the knowledge of how deep his betrayal had run. Alone with the bodies of everyone he worked with. Alone, but alive. Chapter 62. The Pavilion, Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington. Top and Bunny didn't have long to wait. A door opened in the closest of the small buildings and two women came out. It surprised the men to see that one of the women was Jill Hamilton Krajcik, HK, and from her broad smile, it was obvious she enjoyed the surprise. She wore a different blue diamond, this one a pear-shaped cut of at least 4 carats, and half-carat stud earrings. She wore a billed cap in the same shade as her diamonds.
"Well, fellows," she said, coming over and shaking their hands, "welcome to the pavilion."
"Happy to be aboard, ma'am," said Top.
"Yeah, this place looks tight," agreed Bunny. "Love the layout, done right."
"Oh, we do our best," said HK. "And I think you'll be even more impressed once you see what we have under the hood."
She gave them a broad, conspiratorial wink.
"Who's your friend?" asked Top, nodding to the younger woman at her side.
The other woman was a slender blonde in her early 20s, very fit, very pretty, but not at all nice to look at. There was a reptilian coldness in her eyes, and her lips were compressed into a tight red line. She wore camo pants, an olive drab t-shirt, no jewelry, and had a leg brace around her right knee. A Glock 19 was tucked into a low-slung holster, and she had a leather sheath strapped to her left leg, from which the handles of three slim throwing knives protruded. Her pale hair was pulled back into a ponytail so severe it looked painful, and although there were no lines at all on her face, there was an ancient glower in her eyes. Top and Bunny had to fight to keep all reactions from their expressions. They knew her. They'd seen her in surveillance photos and videos.
"This," said HK, "is Eve."
Bunny offered his hand, but Eve stared at him as if he were doing something rude and inappropriate. He withdrew his hand without comment. In his ear, Top heard Scott Wilson say a couple of very crude four-letter words. Then Doc Holliday said,
"It's a good thing our dear outlaw can't see this. He'd have a gall-darn coronary."
Top tapped his button.
"Eve is here overseeing one of our projects," said HK,
beaming with pride and good humor.
"Oh?"
asked Top, but HK did not elaborate. Eve stood beside her as if she'd been cut and pasted into the moment. She ignored the two big men and mostly ignored HK, and instead seemed to look inward into her own thoughts. The energy she radiated was odd and unpleasant. She fidgeted, and her hand kept absently touching the handle of her pistol. Bunny nudged his suitcase.
"Is there some place we can put this stuff? Maybe take a shower and get a hot meal?"
"Oh, of course," said HK. "Where are my manners?"
She led them to one of the buildings used as a bunkhouse. Eve came with them, but remained aloof and apart, not even bothering to look at either of them, and clearly tuning HK out completely. They were put in a large, nicely appointed two-bedroom suite with king beds, soaker tubs and showers, a small dinner table, a big couch, and a massive widescreen TV.
"No cable out here," she said, "but there are a few thousand DVDs in the rec hall, and if there's something playing in the theaters you like, just ask and we can get a screener."
"Cool," said Bunny.
"Not that you'll have much time for watching movies," laughed HK. "We have a lot in store for you fellows."
"Like what?"
"Drop your bags, and I'll give you a quick taste before dinner. How's that?"
"That," said Bunny, "would rock."
They went outside, found a golf cart, and HK drove the four of them to the far side of the compound, an area that proved much larger than they had first thought. There was a cluster of buildings that were actually linked to a larger central structure. Top noticed that Eve began to brighten and become more visibly focused as they entered the building. This, for whatever reason, was clearly important to her. Once they went inside, Top and Bunny found out why. Despite the rather mundane exterior and the rustic setting, the interior was at the bleeding edge of advanced technology. There were racks upon racks of combat exoskeletons, and unlike the stripped-down model Top glimpsed in Texas, these were complete, with structural armor to protect the drivers, belt-fed machine guns, rocket launchers, and other gadgetry that was so exotic, Top didn't know what it was.
"Pappy," said a very excited Doc, "do a slow turn and let me see everything."
There were dozens of the exosuits, each hung on a rack that approximated the dimensions of a person, and, Top saw, each rack was different, suggesting that these machines were designed to the specs of individual users. That was not good, not at all. Along another wall were racks of rifles and handguns, some of which were augmented with different kinds of high-end scopes, personalized trigger mechanisms, and variations on standard designs. On the opposite wall were racks of backpacks. Top recognized some as a new generation of flamethrower, but the others looked like they were built to deliver other payloads, perhaps RPGs or other heavy explosives.
"Oh, lordy, lordy," said Doc. "We are way up the Brown Smelly River, and not one of us has a paddle."
No joke, thought Top. This was not any kind of mercenary training camp. This was a base for staging an all-out war. Staging, and maybe winning it. Beside him, Eve was smiling like a little kid on Christmas morning. Chapter 63. The Darkness. I came back to myself. Slowly. As if from a far-off place. No, not as if. No, that's wrong. I came back from a far place, no doubt. Very goddamned far. 1 minute I was lost inside the darkness, inside my broken head. Then I was sitting with my back to a wall, covered in mud. Blood everywhere, on my hands, on my clothes, in my hair, in my mouth. I looked over at Ghost and he was soaked with it too. I had to look for a long time to assure myself he was breathing. Then he twitched and whined softly the way he does when he's dreaming of pain. I turned and spat my mouth clear and kept spitting until the spit had no lingering traces of pink. My knuckles were torn and I had aches in places I couldn't connect with incidents that might have caused damage. Blood smells like copper and tastes salty. It tastes wrong. I've walked through lakes of it since joining up with Church's goddamned crusade before enlisting in this endless damned war. Professionally, I was indifferent to the smell and the sight of it. Personally, though, I'd never enjoyed spilling it, touching it, smelling it, or tasting it. Until recently, a shiver chopped its way through me. I wondered if this was how vampires were born, not from a bite or a curse, but out of some maniacal need to assure oneself of complete domination over the enemy to the point where the blood in their veins is the wine of victory. Was I becoming that kind of monster? I was bathed in blood. I knew that I'd swallowed some. There was that nausea in the stomach you get from nosebleeds when you swallow your own blood against your will. I'd swallowed it. Why? I couldn't remember. Was it an accident of being in physical line with the hydrostatic release of an artery I'd opened with bullet or blade? Or had I gone even deeper into the arms of the darkness and actually drunk it? Was it some kind of ritual? Undertaken by my deepest need for revenge, to not only end the lives of my enemies, but devour their essence, and by doing so tie their damnation to my own? I closed my eyes for a moment and tried to convince myself that there was still more of me in here than there was that new aspect. It was another round in a fight that had begun in that basement lab in Croatia. The room around me was unfamiliar. An office in a building somewhere. I did not at that moment know where. Not the building, not the town, not the country. My memories of the last several weeks were in my head. But there were chains looped through the door handles and big shiny locks. I kept telling myself that it was a good thing that I lacked a key and could not remove those chains and open those doors until this was done, until it was Santoro's blood boiling in the pit of my stomach, his and Kuga's. But that was a lie. I'd put those chains there. I clicked the padlocks into place, and somewhere in my fractured soul, I had the key. Chapter 64. Twilight. I wandered through the building. It was a laboratory, and that poked a stick into a beehive of memories. But it wasn't until I found a desk with pre-printed envelopes that I realized where I was. Van Dyke Biomechanica in Rotterdam. I stumbled around until I found a bathroom and stood looking at myself in the mirror. If someone had used a hose and sprayed me with red paint, that's how I'd look, except this wasn't paint. There was a sound, and I turned to see Ghost standing behind me, nearly as soaked as I was. His eyes were wild, and he bared his teeth at me. Flash images of things we had both done exploded in my mind. "Ghost," I said, and my voice was not my own. I staggered to the sink, turned on the spigot, and washed my face, and then my mouth, gargled with the water, spat it out, did it again and again, then I drank handfuls of it. I turned back to my dog. He'd inched closer, and the primal wolf still glared out at me from his eyes. "Ghost," I said again. This time, I recognized my own voice. So did he. Ghost rushed at me, whining piteously, jumping up, pushing me back against the wall, pushing his head at my hand, needing me to pet him, needing me to be me. I sank down onto the floor and pulled him close. He kept licking my face, the only part of me not painted with blood. "It's okay," I said softly, kissing his head over and over again. "It's okay." I'd lied to him so many times before. So many times recently. Right now, though, I felt as if I meant it. I hoped it was true.
Chapter 65. The Pavilion. Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington. Top and Bunny sat with a dozen other new recruits and watched something straight out of a science fiction movie. It was no comfort at all that the two of them had seen earlier prototypes of the exoskeleton tech, rather the reverse, because most of what they'd known coming into this was the pervasive belief that this level of sophistication was 5 to 10 years down the road. Not right now. And not rolling out with a major nation's flag stenciled on the hood. This was true, radical combat science. Top wished he could actually have a conversation with Bunny, and another with Wilson and Church, Doc too. And the content of that conversation would likely include calling in an airstrike. One end of the hall was clear of all spectators and was set up as a target range. Though it was an odd one. There were targets of various sizes, each done as a cutout of people, singly and in groups, and vehicles ranging from police cars to armored personnel carriers and even a tank, all fashioned from metal and wood but with stacks of lumber and cinder blocks behind them to give the targets resistance. There were also a few dozen pepper poppers, metal silhouettes lying on the floor but attached to high-tension springs that would cause them to stand up very quickly. From where he was sitting, Top couldn't quite make out what the pepper poppers were intended to represent. As for the standing targets, most were stationary, but several were on wheeled platforms that were in turn attached to a complex pulley system rigged at floor level. A small group of technicians with laptops sat off to one side, close to the targets but behind thick, bulletproof polymer shields. In all, Top counted 18 vehicles and 110 simulated human targets. Very pretty young women, all wearing abbreviated versions of pavilion uniforms that showed off long legs, deep cleavage, and muscular rumps, walked around the room handing out gun range ear defenders. Top accepted one from a woman young enough to be his daughter. Her smile was bright, but there was a glazed, drugged look in her eyes. She also had a lot of makeup caked on her cheek beneath one eye, and Top thought it might be hiding a bruise. HK walked out onto the training floor. She wore a wire mic headset and beamed a great smile, clearly as happy about all this as was Eve. For her part, the younger woman sat on a nicely padded chair, one of a pair someone had brought in for her. The other chair was empty.
The rest of the hall was crammed with more seasoned trainees as well as 40 or more fixers in full pavilion uniforms. Everyone was armed except the people in the bleachers with Top and Bunny. Excitement rippled through the packed house, and Top saw some of the spectators grinning and nudging one another. Apparently, they knew what was coming and were totally into the moment.
"Ladies and gentlemen,"
said HK, affecting the big voice and grand gestures of a circus ringmaster,
"welcome to another edition of Blue Diamond Battle Zone."
It was meant as some kind of inside joke, and it got the expected laugh from the regulars. Eve clapped her hands and stamped her feet on the mat.
"Oh, boy," said Bunny under his breath. "This is going to get weird."
"Hush now, farm boy,"
murmured Top.
"We have a full house today," continued HK. "That's marvelous. So many of you have been with Blue Diamond since it was acquired by our new benefactors."
She didn't give a name, but Top didn't need one. Everything about this was on a grand scale and with massive money and tech savvy behind it. Kuga's name might as well have been in neon lights at the gate. And Top's heart sank at the thought that this was just one camp. Were there others? Here and elsewhere around the world? If so, how many and where?
"And we have some new members to the Blue Diamond family," said HK. "Come on, boys and girls, stand up so everyone can give you a proper hello."
She waved in the direction of the new recruits, and after a moment's surprised hesitation, the people in Top's section got to their feet amid thunderous applause. Top felt like a fool, and he felt incredibly exposed. Bunny, for his part, played to the crowd and raised both hands over his head, making the heavy metal horns hand sign and sticking his tongue out like Gene Simmons from Kiss. That amped the applause up a notch, and the other recruits turned and held fists out for Bunny to bump. When they were all seated again, Top leaned toward Bunny to say something, but the big young man cut him off.
"Don't even, old man."
HK pulled the audience's attention back to her.
"As most of you know," she said, "we're ticking down to game time."
Applause drowned her out for a moment.
"And that means we are going to light things up like nobody's ever seen."
More applause, actual screams and yells. HK held up her hand and the room settled.
"For those of you who haven't yet seen the K-110s in action, you are in for a real treat."
"K-110?
Asked Bunny, but Top shook his head. They both got their answer a moment later. There was a soft whine of hydraulics, and everyone turned to see one of the exosuits come walking out onto the floor. It had an oddly mincing and delicate gait, almost like the velociraptors from Jurassic Park, but it moved quickly with only the slightest perceptible lag between the leg movements of the driver and the servo reactions that made the legs move. The exoskeleton, clearly a K-110 and probably named for Kuga, stepped out onto the floor and turned in a slow, complete circle, allowing everyone to see how well protected the driver was and how fully loaded was the machine itself. Then the K-110 turned another 180 degrees so that it was facing away from the targets. The driver hit a button, and the internal motors immediately powered down, rendering the suit inert. Immediately, six fixers, wearing a kind of body armor Top had only seen in DARPA reports, trotted out onto the floor. They were heavily armed with rifles, handguns, and grenade launchers. The people seated nearest to the K-110 became restive and started to shift away, but HK held up her hand.
"Don't worry, don't worry," she said, patting the air placatingly. "Have a little faith that we didn't bring you all here to kill you."
That got a laugh from everyone except those at the wrong end of the room. But then the soldiers trotted toward the K-110 and formed two tight lines behind the exosuit's bulk, the way soldiers did when going into battle on foot behind a tank.
"Everyone take your seats, please,"
HK called, and when the crowd was settled, she once more raised a hand.
"Danny, give me 20 seconds on the clock."
A large digital clock flared to life over where Eve sat. 20 seconds.
"Wonder how many it'll get," mused Bunny. "I got a 5 spot that says he gets a full third of them."
HK stepped off the floor and, in a voice filled with joy, yelled, "Let the games begin!" What happened next was not a game at all. It was a horror show. Chapter 66. Dawn's Early Light. It took me a long time to get cleaned up. There was a shower adjacent to one of the hot rooms where dangerous biological items were kept. I stripped naked and washed my body until my skin was raw, and washed Ghost until he was a white dog again. The idiot dog liked it, kept wagging his tail. Then I had to find clothes. The only choices were between a dead security guard and a scientist. The scientist's pants fit, the guard's shirt almost fit. I covered it with a white lab coat from a closet. My shoes were leather and they rinsed clean enough. I put my weapons and equipment into a gym bag and the data files I'd stolen into a briefcase. Wearing dead men's clothes, I left the building. On the way out, a man crawled out of a side room on his hands and knees, his clothes stinking of urine and feces. He saw me and screamed, then scuttled back into the room. I fished for his name. DeVries. A sudden crushing desire to kill him punched its way through me. The darkness did not want to let go. Ghost began barking furiously, and I forced myself to turn away and continue making my way toward the front door. The darkness faded. Maybe for once it was glutted. Or maybe the spell was broken. I didn't know and was afraid to even think too much about it. Outside there were no sirens, no cadre of police or fixers or anyone waiting to ambush me. Dawn was breaking on the horizon, as red and bloody as I'd been half an hour ago. I had the scientist's car keys in my pocket and used the fob to locate it with a honk. A blue Saab, last year's model. We drove away. Chapter 67. The Pavilion, Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington. As soon as HK dropped her hand, the lights dimmed and floods splashed bright illumination onto the demonstration floor. A siren began howling and the police started moving the targets. The lights began to strobe, making it nearly impossible to understand what was happening at that end of the hall, and the digital clock began ticking down. Instantly, the K-110 came back online, the contraption seeming to wake up around its driver. The fighting machine turned with surprising and, to top, disheartening agility, swinging around toward the madness. The driver brought the arms up, and even under all the noise, Top could hear a faint whirring noise. Then the back door of hell broke open. The K-110 began stalking forward as the driver opened up with both guns. Shell casings arced through the air as hundreds of rounds chunked into the moving targets, punched holes through the metal, and tunneled through the wood and cinder block. Those rounds chewed up the rear wall of the structure. The standing targets were obliterated in moments, even though the police tried to yank them away at high rates of speed. Top realized that the exosuit had some kind of persistent aiming system that locked onto targets, chased them, got ahead of them, and chewed them to pieces. Pepper poppers sprang up from the floor, and now Top could see that some were civilians of four distinct kinds. Official-looking men and women in good suits, wearing American flag pins on their lapels and broad photo-op smiles. Other men and women wearing the dark suits, white shirts, dark ties of Secret Service agents, all the way down to sunglasses and wires behind their ears. People wearing T-shirts or hats with various political party slogans, both right and left wing, and more of the fixers in the fancy body armor. The K-110's machine guns fired continuously, cutting every single member of the first three groups to pieces, but somehow, despite noise, movement, strobes, and gun smoke, selectively ignoring the fixers. As the field was cleared, the K-110's left machine gun stopped firing and swung around and down on a hidden track, allowing a weapon with a bigger mouth to roll up and lock in place. A grenade launcher. It fired 8 rounds, and each one struck one of the bigger target vehicles with enough destructive force to blow them to pieces. Debris filled the air and rained down, but none of it fell on the spectators. The 6 fixers behind the fighting machine now spread out and ran forward, using their weapons to guarantee that any target with a wound was given a kill shot. The K-110 still fired with its right arm machine gun, but even with the fixers moving all over the floor, not one round so much as scratched them. And then it was over. Just like that. The echo of the gunfire banged off the walls for a few seconds but died away into a ghastly silence. Even the fixers in the pavilion uniforms seemed surprised, dazed. Perhaps they had never seen a demonstration of this magnitude before. Then someone began clapping. All heads turned toward a small man standing by an open door. He was dressed in a brown suit with a European cut, a swarthy man with glittering dark eyes. A few fixers joined in the applause, and as if that was the last thing holding back a collapsing dam, everyone in the hall began applauding. The entire crowd leaped to their feet, clapping, yelling, roaring out, slapping one another on the back, grinning with overwhelming joy. Eve jumped to her feet and ran over to the small man, threw her hands around his neck and kissed him on the cheek, the way a daughter would kiss her much-loved father. Top and Bunny were the last to start clapping, but they joined in, forcing enthusiasm past the walls of their horror and shock. Not just at the level of destruction they'd witnessed, a degree of deadly combat efficiency beyond anything they'd ever seen, but because of that man. Because of him. In his ear, Top heard Scott Wilson hiss, as if burned. He heard Doc Holliday say, "Oh my God," over and over again. And nearly buried beneath the weight of that crushing adulation, he heard Mr. Church speak the name. Raphael Santoro. Chapter 68. The Pavilion, Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington. The crowd surged forward around Raphael Santoro, Eve, and HK. Everyone seemed eager to elbow their fellows out of the way to shake hands with the small Spaniard, and to a lesser degree, HK. No one offered a hand to Eve, and she seemed okay with that. Santoro was ebullient, smiling broadly, accepting the offered hands and shaking briskly, pausing to speak to specific individuals, even hugging a few. He exchanged cheek kisses with HK and leaned closely to speak quietly into her ear, and the executive blushed a bright red, her eyes twinkling with happiness. Top and Bunny lingered near the very back of the crowd. With Bunny's height and mass, it was tough to remain inconspicuous, but they managed. Shifts in body posture change height and alter physical presence. Staying out of Santoro's line of sight was key because even though they'd never met, there was no chance at all that their faces were unknown to the man.
"Never thought that fucker would be here,"
said Bunny quietly.
"Uh-huh,"
agreed Top, putting a lot of meaning into those two syllables. In their ears, Wilson said,
"Chaps, you really need to get the hell out of that room."
Bunny turned toward Top's button camera and pretended to scratch his chin with his extended forefinger. Leaving was not an option because it would draw too much attention. This was their first day at the pavilion, and any unusual movements would be dangerous, if not fatal. So instead, they drifted over to where a couple of techs were helping the K-110's driver out of the fighting machine. There were a series of snap releases, but it still took assistance to disengage. As Top saw it, that was one of very damned few design flaws. The driver was sweating and accepted a towel and a bottle of water from a friend.
"That's one hell of a show," said Top, coming over to shake the driver's hand.
"Thanks, man," said the driver. He glanced at Top and Bunny's street clothes. "You boys new?"
"New kids in school, brah,"
said Bunny. Welcome to the monkey house, said the driver, grinning broadly. He stripped off his sweat-sodden shirt and tied it around his waist. Top noticed that there was a small, barely healed scar on his upper chest, about the size and placement typical of a pacemaker. It was the fifth or sixth time he'd seen a fixer here with the same scar, but now wasn't the time to ask. The driver looked at his machine with obvious, genuine affection. What do you think?
It's fucking awesome, said Bunny,
and Top thought that the big man didn't need to feign his enthusiasm. As frightening as the demonstration was, the level of technology was so superior that it was, undeniably, impressive as hell. Top tapped the K-110's shell.
Can you run in this thing?
Yeah, said the driver. But she's a pig. Turns fast, fires fast, runs like a cow. But hey, after all that shit, I can just stroll away.
I heard that, said Bunny. Totally badass. Like, serious next-level Star Wars badass.
You got that right.
How much of your ammo did you burn through?
Asked Top. All of it. Except two grenades, said the driver. Once it's spent, the weight is cut in half, but it's still slow getting out of Dodge.
That why you have the ground troops? Asked Top. Cover your back for exfil?
I guess, said the driver. We haven't really gone into exfiltration logistics yet. That's coming up, I hear.
He was about to say more, and then indicated something with an uptick of his chin.
Here comes the man.
Top and Bunny glanced across the room and saw that Santoro was heading their way, flanked by Eve and HK. Gonna peel back and let you get your kudos, said Top.
Totally awesome demo, man, said Bunny.
They swapped fist bumps with the driver and then melted into the thickest part of the crowd, angling away from Santoro's path.
They saw the Spaniard embrace the driver and then link arms with him and walk the fixer toward the door. They vanished into the sunlight outside. A supervisor came over and herded the new recruits into a bunch, told them to go back to their rooms and get some rest. Armed fixers accompanied the recruits, and once inside, Top and Bunny heard the locks click from outside. That left them in their shared suite. There was no chance at all that the rooms were not being monitored, so they did not fall into conversation about what they'd seen. Instead, they took turns using the bathroom, made some food in the kitchen, and while eating had a conversation of exactly the kind men like they were pretending to be would have. Then they went to bed. Top lay awake for a long time, replaying every detail about what happened. There were so many things about all of this that scared the living hell out of him, and so few things on which he could hang the thin garment of his hope. Sleep came reluctantly, and it was filled with very bad dreams. Chapter 69 Maria Beatrice Hospital, Florence, Italy. When the door to his private room opened and the man stepped in, Alexander Fong nearly screamed. The shriek got as far as his throat when he realized that this was not the same man. This was not the monster. But the similarities, same height, similar coloring, blue eyes and blonde hair, and the same muscular build and pantherish walk. But it was not the man who'd nearly killed him. It was not the maniac who'd murdered all of Fong's colleagues and destroyed their research. It was not the cruel bastard who'd forced him to betray the organization. This man wore a lab coat and carried a clipboard, and he had a stethoscope looped around his neck.
Dr. Fong? Asked the man, smiling disarmingly. I'm Dr. Bianchi.
His name was Northern Italian, but the accent? Was it genuine? Fong wasn't sure. He'd grown up in Tuscany, but his own accent had Cantonese overtones because his parents had always spoken it at home.
Yes, said Fong uncertainly.
Bianchi came into the room, closed the door, and